Today is Wednesday, October 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Israel and Lebanon begin talks today aiming at ending a maritime dispute.
If the talks go well, it will be possible to move forward towards a deal within weeks or months.
Plus, campaigning in a key state in the U.S. presidential election.
Latinos, projected to be the nation's largest group of ethnic minority voters, will be a factor in the election.
And the pandemic's booming business in South Korea. We'll have these stories and more next. Lebanon and Israel began indirect talks over their disputed maritime border, with U.S. officials mediating the talks. From Beirut via WhatsApp, George Eid has the details.
Well, it is a long process since it has been tackled a few times over the years. However, today, Lebanon and Israel held a short opening round of indirect talks over their disputed maritime border on Wednesday. The meeting that lasted for an hour ended after a second round was announced to be held on October 28th. The talks were held at the headquarters of the UN Interim Force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, in Nakura, just north of the UN demarcated blue line separating Israel and Lebanon. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs David Schenker and UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon Jan Kubis attended the historic opening session. Negotiators that sat around the same table did not talk directly to each other. A UN mediator instead was communicating each team's message to the other. This shows a bit the type of relation that exists between Lebanon and Israel. Israel sent a seven-member team, including the Director General of its Energy Ministry, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's foreign policy advisor, and the head of the Army Strategic Division, along with another military member. Lebanon's four-member delegation had included two army officers, a Lebanese oil official, and a maritime border law expert.
George, as you mentioned, this isn't the first time the two nations have tried to sort this out and had discussions to resolve this issue. What's been the reaction to the talks where you are in Beirut?
Iran-backed militia Hezbollah and its ally Amal had criticized the delegation representing Lebanon at the talks. In a statement issued a few hours before the meeting, the two main Shia parties called for the reform of the negotiating team, which they claimed must include only military officials without any civilians or politicians, because it contradicts the 1996 framework agreement, which allows only military officers to attend the periodic meeting on border demarcation. Also, the Lebanese government expressed on Monday opposition to the presidency's mechanism of appointing the four-member negotiation team.
And what about Israel?
Israeli media reported that the senior Israeli energy ministry official said that if the talks go well, it will be possible to move forward towards a deal within weeks or months, as he claimed. The head of the Lebanese delegation in the demarcation negotiations, Brigadier General Bassam Yassin, said after the meeting that indirect technical negotiations are a first step in a 1,000-mile march of the demarcation of the southern borders. And he added, "We are looking forward to proceed at a pace that will enable us to complete this file within a reasonable time limit." He also hoped that the other parties will fulfill their obligation according to the requirements of international law, and they will preserve the confidentiality of the talks.
George Eid reports from Beirut, Lebanon. It is U.S. President Donald Trump's first week back on the campaign trail since his COVID-19 diagnosis, after his doctor said that he is no longer infectious to others. With 3 weeks left to go until Election Day, Trump and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden are crisscrossing the battleground states to energize their supporters. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the details.
Trump is the best. From Florida to Ohio, supporters rally around their candidates as the countdown continues to Election Day. In the battleground state of Florida, attendees received temperature checks for President Donald Trump's first rally since he was diagnosed with COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus.
But it's great to be back in my home state, Florida, to make my official return to the campaign trail.
In actions and words, Trump addressed his recovery from COVID-19.
Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience.
The science is unclear on immunity to COVID-19. But in quite a different type of gathering in Ohio, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden criticized Trump's handling of his illness.
It's just reckless personal conduct since his diagnosis as well has been unconscionable. And the longer Donald Trump is president, the more reckless he gets.
Trump may be trying to project strength in his response, says Stanford University political scientist Bruce Kane.
I'm not sure that there was a better way to spin it. I mean, certainly if he looked vulnerable and weak and sick, it would have been bad for him too.
But Trump's treatment of his illness and recovery could backfire, says Kane.
His reaction to the COVID and some of the statements he's made about COVID and his immunity and lack of vulnerability to it are not playing well with the older voters. And Florida is a state with a lot of retirees, a lot of people who are vulnerable to not only getting sick, but potentially dying from COVID.
While Trump won Florida in 2016, it is up for grabs in 2020. The latest poll shows Biden with a slim lead over Trump in Florida, a critical state for both candidates.
What Mr. Trump is trying to do is to get his people out, get them energized, get them out to vote. Because if he can get white male voters in particular to show up in big numbers, he can offset some of the losses that he's had among women and among older voters. The emphasis of the Biden campaign is essentially make sure you don't make the same mistakes that Hillary did.
I want to thank the Hispanic Americans.
Latinos, projected to be the nation's largest group of ethnic minority voters, will be a factor in the election. National polls show them backing Biden more than 2-1, although Trump does better among Cuban Americans, a major voting group in Florida. The issue for voters that stands out above all others, says Kane, will be COVID-19. And Americans will cast their ballots to show who they want at the helm as the country fights the disease. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, said on Tuesday at her U.S. Senate confirmation hearing, she is not hostile to the health care law known as Obamacare, as Democrats have suggested. She also declined to specify whether she believes landmark rulings legalizing abortion and gay marriage were properly decided. Reuters' Yahaira Yaquez has this report.
Judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
In day two of her confirmation hearings, Barrett, a conservative federal appellate judge, declined to answer whether she believed Roe v. Wade, which recognized a woman's constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy, was properly decided.
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question. But again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, whom she was speaking to, was not pleased.
On something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all, it's distressing not to get a straight answer.
Barrett would also now comment on whether she agreed with the late conservative justice, Antonin Scalia, that the 2015 Supreme Court ruling legalizing gay marriage nationwide was wrongly decided.
Senator Feinstein, as I said to Senator Graham at the outset, if I were confirmed, you would be getting Justice Barrett, not Justice Scalia. So I don't think that anybody should assume that just because Justice Scalia decided a decision a certain way, that I would too.
On the topic of the Affordable Care Act, Barrett declined to say whether she would recuse herself, if confirmed, from considering an upcoming case in which President Trump and Republican-led states are seeking to invalidate Obamacare.
So that's not a question that I could answer in the abstract.
Or from any case that may arise if there is a legal dispute over the outcome of the November presidential election.
Absolutely not.
She was insistent that no one at the White House saw a commitment from her on how she would rule on any issue.
I have had no conversation with the president or any of his staff on how I might rule in that case. It would be a gross violation of judicial independence for me to make any such commitment or for me to be asked about that case and how I would rule.
Republicans have a majority in the Senate, making Barrett's confirmation to a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court a virtual certainty.
You would be getting Justice Barrett.
Her nomination offers the chance to cement a conservative majority on the court for years to come. And if confirmed, she'd be President Trump's third justice on the high court.
Yehera Yaquez reports for Reuters News. Barrett is back in front of the senators today, with their hearing expected to wrap up on Thursday. A Russian attempt to broker a ceasefire amid the worst outbreak of hostilities over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh in more than a quarter century has failed to gain any traction. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Wednesday that fighting between ethnic Armenian and Azeri forces in the Nagorno-Karabakh region should stop immediately and that the conflict should be resolved through diplomatic means. Azerbaijan and Armenia are the two nations battling over the area, trading blame for the new attacks. However, in this report narrated by Jonathan Speer, the truce, albeit imperfect, has given at least some respite to the residents.
The sounds of war still reverberate in Nagorno-Karabakh's mountains, less so in Stepanakert, the capital of this unrecognized state. Food stores offer what little products they have to customers weary from what are now 3 long weeks of war.
I can't stay at home. Whatever is available here, I do not receive any more goods. Whatever I had is gradually running out. Whoever needs something, I stay here.
When bombs are not falling on the city, for residents, it's time to remove the rubble and assess the damage, including some incalculable ones, such as those caused by the bombing of the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour, a symbol of Christianity in this part of the Caucasus. As local authorities see it, these attacks on civilian targets have been intentional.
We analysed the cases and showed that in many cases there were deliberate targetings to the civilian objects and civilian population, because they used highly accurate rockets or missiles, and also UAVs, drones, striking drones, either striking or suicide drones.
Azerbaijan denies targeting civilians as emergency crews collect and detonate projectiles that have fallen on the city during the last days.
We are going to remove all the ammunition, everything that could pose a danger to people's lives.
Azeri drones continue to soar over Stepanakert as its people try to restore some normalcy to their lives, with what has become an ever-present fear that the fighting could restart at any moment. For Pablo Gonzalez in Stepanakert, Nagorno-Karabakh, I'm John Speer, VOA News.
And coming up later,
we have also been working to seek a response from Chinese authorities in relation to the accusations that have been made publicly.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Conchita Ferrell, who was known for her role as Berta the housekeeper on TV's 2.5 Men, has died. She was 77. Ferrell died Monday at Sherman Oaks Hospital in Los Angeles following cardiac arrest, according to her publicist. A judge has ordered Tory Lanez to make no contact with Megan Thee Stallion at a court hearing on felony charges alleging he shot her. Lanez, real name Daystar Peterson, is accused of assault with a semi-automatic firearm and carrying a loaded, unregistered firearm in a vehicle. Stars including Nicole Kidman and George Clooney celebrated aspiring young creators whose organizations have been granted millions by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. More than $5.1 million in funds were given over to 70 nonprofit organizations during the HFPA Philanthropy Empowering the Next Generation virtual event on Tuesday. This is Sam Golding with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Another pharmaceutical company halted testing of an experimental COVID-19 drug treatment because of safety concerns. U.S.-based Eli Lilly and Company announced on Tuesday that the clinical trial of its coronavirus antiviral drug had been paused by independent monitors out of an abundance of caution, but they did not go into details. A day before the pause, U.S. drug maker Johnson & Johnson halted its late-stage clinical trials of its experimental vaccine after a patient was diagnosed with an unexplained illness. According to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University in the United States, there have been more than 38.1 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. In South Korea, some of the world's biggest food delivery firms are scrambling to surf an estimated $4 billion wave of new orders, contracting thousands of new workers in a boom triggered by the coronavirus pandemic. Reuters' Gloria So has that part of the story.
Cruising through the streets of Seongnam, South Korea on her motorbike, 37-year-old Choi Young-ah works one of the country's most promising coronavirus-era jobs as a food delivery driver. With the health crisis keeping millions at home, orders have shot up by some 40% this year in South Korea. It's the third largest food delivery market in the world, and the demand for drivers has never been higher. Choi was an art teacher by day, but struggled to make ends meet after the health crisis forced her to shut down her classes. So she's traded in her paintbrush for a helmet, joining thousands of new drivers taking advantage of the delivery market boom.
I was under pressure to find something new. Some people are struggling while others are expanding their businesses. Fried chicken shops, for example, are booming. I feel lucky I found this field at a time when deliveries are booming.
Choi says she already earns 9 times the average pay she took home as a part-time art instructor. And companies are now offering bonuses to secure faster drivers willing to work rain or shine. But the competition for jobs in food delivery is likely to remain fierce. Many South Koreans have been seen lining up at job fairs as the country's unemployment rate surged to its highest in more than a decade in May. But Choi says she will keep up her passion for art as a hobby rather than her profession, choosing the motorbike helmet over her pencils for the foreseeable future.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Pro-democracy protesters in Thailand pushed through several sets of police barricades on Wednesday as they sought to take their grievances to the government. Royalist backers of King Maha Wachi Rolulangkorn staged a rival show of support as political tension continues growing after 3 months of demonstrations. The royal palace has not responded to any requests for comment on the protests or the protesters' demands. The Kremlin said Wednesday that Russia had not done a deal with the United States to extend the New START arms pact, the last major nuclear arms treaty between the two countries, despite U.S. assertions of significant progress. The New START Accord, signed in 2010, limits the number of strategic nuclear warheads that Russia and the United States can deploy. It expires in February 2021. The U.S. officials had indicated on social media that an agreement to extend it had been reached in principle. The leaders of the far-right Golden Dawn, once Greece's third-largest political party, were sentenced to prison on Wednesday for running a criminal gang linked to hate crimes during the country's worst economic crisis in decades. The court handed down 13-year jail terms to 6 former lawmakers, including Golden Dawn's leader. The court also imposed a life sentence and 10 years in jail for Golden Dawn member Yorgos Rupakeas for the 2013 murder of anti-fascist rapper Pavlos Fisas. Australia is trying to clarify reports of a Chinese ban on its coal imports. Industry sources have said Beijing told energy providers and steel firms to stop buying Australian coal. Trade tensions between the Asia-Pacific partners have deteriorated in recent years, and Phil Mercer has that story.
Coal is one of the major Australian commodity exports to China, behind iron ore and liquefied natural gas. So any disruption to this multi-billion dollar trade would hurt. State-owned energy providers and steel mills in China have reportedly been told not to buy Australian coal. Australian officials believe it could be temporary and part of informal quotas in China, or an attempt to restrict imports to protect China's domestic coal mining industry. However, analysts have speculated that the reported ban on Australian coal could be part of an emerging trade war. Earlier this year, China was infuriated when Canberra called for a global investigation into COVID-19, which was first detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Relations have also soured over allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic politics, cyber espionage, and the detention of Australian citizens in China. Beijing has accused Australia of being anti-China. Australian Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says he's not confirmed that coal exports to China are being disrupted.
We have also been working to seek a response from Chinese authorities in relation to the accusations that have been made publicly. But we take the reports seriously enough, certainly, to try to seek some assurances from Chinese authorities that they are honouring the terms of the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement.
Earlier this year, Beijing effectively banned imports of Australian barley, placed restrictions on meat, and discouraged students and others from travelling to Australia. In August, China said it had launched an anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine imports. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Australia owes its recent prosperity in large part to Chinese demand for iron ore and other resources. Given this economic reality, standing up to Beijing isn't easy. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Technology with surveillance capabilities is increasing exponentially, and with it, the potential for it to be misused to violate human rights. That's why the State Department has released guidance for American companies on how to prevent their products or services from being misused by foreign governments to commit human rights violations and abuses, said Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Scott Busby. Products or services with intended and unintended surveillance capabilities have the potential to provide positive contributions to a country's economic, defense, and societal well-being. For example, such products or services can be used to safeguard election systems from interference. But too often, surveillance technologies and products are misused by foreign governments to stifle dissent, harass human rights defenders, intimidate minority communities, discourage whistleblowers, chill free expression, target political opponents, journalists, and lawyers, or interfere arbitrarily or unlawfully with privacy. In some cases, foreign governments have misused such products or services to subject entire populations to arbitrary or unlawful surveillance. China is one country that has taken a very restrictive approach to the internet and is using surveillance technology widely in violation of international human rights standards, said Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby. This includes pervasive high-tech surveillance in Xinjiang, where the PRC has implemented a campaign of repression against Uyghurs, ethnic Kazakhs, and members of other Muslim minority groups. Other governments around the world are employing the same technology on their citizens. Iran, Venezuela, and according to a 2019 Wall Street Journal investigation, Algeria, Uganda, and Zambia. It has never been more important for U.S. businesses to implement policies that protect against the misuse of their products. We must continue to advance innovation that complements our approach to human rights, said Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby, including the right to be free from arbitrary or unlawful interference with privacy and freedom of expression, as well as respect for the rule of law. We look forward to working with the U.S. business community and implementing this guidance and ensuring that American companies continue to reflect the strongest of American values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.